Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, the ESPN College Football Podcast. The ESPN College Football Podcast is now 5 days a week. Hosts Kirk Herbstreit, David Pollack, and Kevin Ogunde are back and joined this year by Reese Davis, Matt Berry, Paul Feinbaum, Booger McFarland, and Joey Galloway. From weekend reaction to Monday mornings to previews, the ESPN College Football Podcast has it covered by the voices and perspectives you'll want to hear from. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if there's a game, someone's betting on it. Stream Season 2 of Better Days, the Mike Greenberg-hosted series that brings the true stories of unforgettable gambling adventures to life. All episodes are streaming, only on ESPN. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is Foxword Friday. Dominique Foxworth, what's going on, man?
What's happening? I'm just excited because you just said, I know where I'm going to start, but I'm not going to tell you. So the anticipation is building. I'm happy to be back. That week off was rough on the people and rough on me, too.
Hey, man, football season on the way, baby. Like, it's here. I'm curious about this with you. You're a fairly level guy, but I've met you since you had kind of washed all the NFL off of you, right? Yeah. How many years was it before that first week of the year didn't have you, like, charged up wanting to play some football?
Oh, so it was a weird thing. I was fine immediately. Like, right after, I retired, and there were still contracts on the table, and I retired. So, like, I wanted to retire. But it was going to an NFL game that changed that for me, where, like, that was the first time where I was like, oh, maybe I would want to play. It's those minutes before a game starts and that you see all the noise, you get all excited, you hear all the thumping music. That's the only time that I'm like, man, it'd be nice to be out there. And then somebody get hit. And I'm like, eh, real nice over here in this box, real comfy. Go grab me a hot dog right fast.
Yeah, I imagine, like, I don't know if you saw this with Derek Jeter at the Hall of Fame, where he got the ovation. It was like, man, I forgot what that feels like. You know, yeah. Like, I have no thing in my life that is at all comparable to what that is. And I don't trust nice things people say about me. So, like, I don't know necessarily, like, you know, what direction I go in. But I tell you a story. It's of a non-football player, but it changed the way I looked at all kinds of stuff. So when I was in college, I had participated in something, and my senior year, we were being honored at the football game. All right, we were going to be honored at halftime of the football game. And I'm sitting next to another cat. He's with me. He's going to be honored in the same thing that I'm in. And he was a band dude, but for whatever reason, he was not in the band that year. And I think he was like a sophomore in college or whatever. But I'm sitting next to him, and he's all antsy. And I'm like, dude, what's going on? And he just looked at me and said, I've never been to a football game without an instrument before. Like, he had no idea what to do with himself at a game if he wasn't playing in the band. You know, like, the band, you know, we black people, right? It means something different. The band was his bag. And so I could imagine for guys, like, now you one of the dots. Like, Dominique, well, we joke with Dominique about this clip of him laying on the ground trying to tackle Michael Turner. And he's like, yep, that's me on the ground. And that's you. Them dots in the crowd. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And then you were sitting there being a dot.
Yeah, being a dot is different. And I think the point about feeling the crowd is something I didn't understand that I appreciated, because it was part of my life, you know? Like, you grow up in something, it's part of your life, and it's just a thing. And then you go and step away, and you're like, oh, yeah, that was nice. I think that's the thing that I struggle with the most in retirement, is, like, feeling like what I'm doing is consequential. I had to fight to convince myself that the stuff that I was doing was less consequential than it actually was, like, for all this time. But now, and just about everything else that you've done after football, it doesn't feel nearly as consequential, because nobody really cares that much, you know? In football, there is really no true consequence if you lose or you give up a touchdown. Like, there are consequences for your life, there are consequences for the team. But you would have thought that your city just got sacked. You thought that there's a new ruler. Like, this means that we are under new authoritarian regime. And that felt good. Even when things didn't go badly, it felt good to go to bed and wake up and be like, man, these people depended on me. You know, like, I don't know what you don't think about it at the time. It feels like stress, and it is stress. But when you get away from it, it's hard. I think it's a weird situation to go through. And it's probably something that you can't relate to unless you're 65. Like, you go from feeling like you matter your whole life when you're 65, all of a sudden you retire, and people, like, we don't have one of those cultures that really reveres the elderly. So mm-hmm. like once you old and you are no longer productive, people are like, eh, you don't matter. Imagine going through that at 35.
At least you were built for the transition. Like, right. So one thing I looked at with Tim Tebow, and I was long on the go get a job. Right. Like I was very much on the why don't you go get a job program, especially since the jobs he was getting paid a lot of money. Right. And I guess he was still doing these jobs, but still trying to play baseball, 30 something years old out here, still trying to play football. But what I had to remember about him is he's homeschooled. Yeah. And I imagine for him, and I've found from talking to former athletes and football players in particular, the biggest thing for them in terms of making the transition or moving away is the relationships, you know, like that feeling of being part of something there. And I thought about it with Tebow. He ain't never been part of a group probably other than being on a team. And so I imagine for him when he's not on that, one thing about Tebow and all the stuff we talk about and everything else, I do have to say this. And if you were homeschooled, you might get a little twinge out of this, but you know I'm right. He about as normal as one could reasonably expect. Like he homeschooled plus PK. At the same time, like he came out about as normal as one person could expect for somebody to come out. And so I look at a guy like him, it must have been rough that first time. Not only for him, he went from star football player to not football player with no steps in between.
I said 35. He did it in his 20s.
Yes.
That's got to be really tough. And it's interesting because I heard you on the Wednesday pod talking to Joel and was saying similar things like these guys at Bishop Sycamore, they need to go get a job. And I understand where you're coming from, but and this probably connects to if we're going to talk about The Wire and Omar, like it ain't about the money. And for Omar, it wasn't about the money. Yeah. And for Tim Tebow and for people who are playing football, it's about the money to some degree, but it's also not really about the money. You're doing it for other reasons. Like I mentioned, it was for me, part of it after I got the money, because it was all about the money up until I got some money. Then mm-hmm. I got some money, and then it was about other things. It's about pride and feeling important and feeling valuable, and or at least close to as valuable as you once felt in a world that is telling you that you are not nearly as important as you thought you were.
Yeah, and see the thing like with Bishop Sycamore, I'm looking at it and I'm like, yeah, man, but y'all laid out on the floor. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's why I'm just like, you don't know you need to go get a job, but you should go get a job.
The thing that I think you don't understand because you're a pretty rational person. Like you have some emotions like all of us, but generally I think of you as a rational person.
And yeah,
you
pretty find sober.
And you got economics degree, which suggests that you spent a lot of time around a lot of other rational people. You don't realize how irrational everybody else is.
Yes.
Like that's, you don't realize that. So like while you're telling this story about them sleeping on the floor and sharing a bathroom and how miserable it is, you know what they thinking? This is going to look great in my documentary when I'm MVP of the NFL. I'm going to tell them I was sleeping on the floor because I wanted it more. I was hungry. And for every one person that does have that story, there's probably countless of them in the NFL who have these sob stories about how they had to overcome so much. And even if they don't have them, they create them because that's what we sell. They're going to create a sob story for you. And all these people who have these successful sob stories, valid or invalid, are fueling all these millions of other people who end up having a sob story without the triumph at the end. Yeah.
You know what them dudes did? They packed up that U-Haul and they moved to New York and they was going to get a record deal.
Exactly. Right? Like,
you know what? Now that you mentioned it, that is exactly what it
and
is.
And then when something goes wrong, they're like, I'm a persevere because I'm a dog. I'm a fight. Because that's what we tell them.
And I guess I also hadn't thought about the fact that, like, if you play it against IMG, then you put up this film against IMG, and there's a chance that somebody's going to look at the film and be like, hey, who's that dude over there? Yeah, the one with the helmet that ain't like the rest of the guys on the team. Yeah. What's up with that guy? Is that because he the team captain? Oh, right? Man. Like, is that what that direction is? But you tapped into something, too, that I was actually thinking about this because a buddy of mine was talking about it, which is the idea of purpose. And like we find purpose in work in this capitalist society.
Right.
And so coal mining is a great place to go talk about this. You can get into like the J.D. Vance hillbilly elegy type stuff. Did you read that, by the way?
Yeah.
So I read it because people told me that you needed to read it to kind of understand poor white people. And I was like, I know poor white people, but fine, I'll go ahead and check it out. And then I read it and I was like, man, if a black person had wrote this book about black people, he would have been all the Uncle Toms. Yeah. Like, we would have been calling him every kind of sellout and bootlicker and you don't forgot where you came from and everything else in it. But that whole realm of things, and you go to like the coal mining thing, whether you think it makes sense to mine coal or not, we're like, yo, man, you know, you're going to get a black lung. You know, we moving on to other forms of energy and stuff. Whether you agree with it or whether you think it makes sense, the thing about it is, and I've been picking up on this too, like listening to that Sturgill, they find purpose in that mine.
Right.
You know, like that, for whatever reason, doesn't matter whether you think it makes sense or not, they find purpose and dignity in that sort of work. And so I think those cats at Bishop Sycamore will find dignity out there playing football that they will not find flipping them burgers.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. And I can speak to that personally. And I think that's like the root of when people say money doesn't buy happiness. And that's something that you, I think, have said recently. And you and I both, growing up, we thought, oh, you get rich and you good. I assume. I know I did. And then you get some money and you're like, no, that's not what life's about. Or at least you feel like that's not what life's about. The thing about dignity and purpose and feeling a part of something, I'd give up a lot of money to have that, you know?
Man, I feel bad for people who think that money gonna bring them happy. I really, really do. Because I did not grow up poor at all, right? We didn't grow up rich, but I certainly didn't grow up poor, and I did not grow up, like, there was nothing that I really looked at and was like, man, I can't wait till I got enough money, because then I'm gonna dot, dot, dot. Like, I felt like anything that mattered, I was able to get, like, via my parents or anything else. And then I came around, and then
you're reasonable and rational. That's the problem. Because I was a kid and I wasn't poor either, but I had those same thoughts. But I ended with, gotta get this money. It'll fix all that.
Yeah, but see, my dad got some more radical political beliefs, shall we say.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
So here's what we were, though, right? We had a pool in the backyard. Now, in Houston, that don't mean the same thing as it does in other places, because in the 80s, you could come up on a little bit of money and get some stuff. So we had a pool in the backyard. But the people I went to school with had Nintendos. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, my daddy had a car with nice leather seats in it, right? But them people that I went to school with had Jordans. Because my parents just weren't buying me a Nintendo, and my parents just weren't buying me Jordans. We could have got those. Like, all the things that I got the money and then wanted was, like, shoes. You know what I'm saying? Things that were, like, reasonably affordable, but it wasn't anything that I thought was, like, going full on change my life. And so I imagine, especially if you grow up like destitute, like, you know, poor like my daddy grew up type of thing, it's got to make everything a whole lot better to not have to worry about money anymore. Because most people spend every day waking up worrying about money, but it ain't going to make you happy. Like, that's the difference. Like, whenever I see people online, they'll be like, yo, money doesn't make you happy. Well, I'd like to find out. I'm sure you would. And you're going to get that money and you're going to find out. No, it just doesn't work that way.
You're right. And I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with you in that I feel sorry for people who think that money is going to make them happy. But I think you would agree with me is I feel more sorry for people who is really broke.
Yes. You know what I mean?
Like, that is much worse. And that's where people are coming from, where they're like, get some money. So, like, we talked about me going to business school. Before I went to business school, like, my plan was like, I'm going to take this money I have now, then I'm going to turn it into hundreds of millions of dollars. And then I got there and it had the reverse impact on me. And I looked around, I was like, this ain't happiness. Like, you know, I have the good fortune of, like, having choices. That's what money gives you. It gives you choices. And I had a good fortune to make choices. Am I going to make the choice to do the same miserable thing that these other people are doing just so I can, like, put more points on the scoreboard? Like, that didn't make sense to me. But still, I can't kill a competitiveness in me. I still be trying to get that money, mostly just so I can so I can feel validated.
Dog, you was like me when I looked around at the B-school classes, and I was like, I don't like any of these people. I'll never forget, I went to Claremont Graduate University at the Peter Drucker School of Management. You may have heard of Peter Drucker. Wrote a whole lot of those business books. Like, he's a G among G's in that world. And I just remember one day I'm sitting there, this Japanese cat came up to me, right? And he was clearly not a native English speaker. So I'm telling you that just because if you don't grow up on the West Coast, you don't really come across people who sound like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm just not used to having a conversation with somebody who talks in this cadence. And I had this book called Sex, Lies, and Headlocks. It was by Sean Asale, who used to work at ESPN the magazine. And it was a look at the WWE. It was a very interesting book on the WWE. And it's got this wild picture of Vince McMahon on the cover. And the guy looks at me and was like, Vince McMahon, I love him. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, he's just such a good marketer and promoter. And I was like, oh, that's your value structure.
Right.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Like, I look at Vince and I think of all the terribleness that comes along with getting that money. And he's like, what are you talking about? He's getting that money. Like this is what it is. And I looked all around that room in them B-school classes. And I was like, first of all, y'all ain't that smart. Yeah. Like the econ classes, totally different level of intellect that you were dealing in there. Because if you do an economics, you in it because you really want to get deeper into the study, like, you know, like the actual academic elements of it. People in B school, they just try to get that bread. They might learn something while they there, but that ain't why they went.
We got a big class size, so it's 900. I think it's probably the biggest business school. Like, most business schools are like 150, 250 people. So, like, there are those type of people who are not that bright, but, like, got connections. Then there are the people who are incredibly intelligent. There's, like, a whole benevolent crew who's out there trying to save the world and use the things you can learn at B school. But I looked around and was like, y'all all really working real hard, and I want to be happy, and or at least work hard for something that I want to work hard for. You know what I mean? Like, I got like two people I keep in touch with from B-School out of a class of 900, but I was just at a different point in my life. Let me take you back to one thing that I meant to mention earlier. We're talking about the pipe dream that has these guys at Bishop Sycamore, and frankly, mm-hmm. has a lot of people around the country believing that they about to hit it big. We perpetuate this myth as a society because we tell them that the difference between the people who make it and the people who don't, the difference is they worked harder, they sacrificed more, they wanted it more. That's important, but that ain't the difference. The no. difference is like talent and luck. Like, that is the difference. You are born with talent, and maybe you can put yourself in places to get more lucky, but wanting it more, I think I wrote this quote down a long time ago that Michael Wilbon said. He was like, if desire was what made people good, I'd be Ernie Banks. Yeah. You are absolutely right. But Michael Wilbon is Michael Wilbon.
And the difficulty is, like, if you're Michael Wilbon, you can't properly give that advice to somebody. Like, I tell this story. I don't think I've told you this story. And it's a small level story, but I think you'll feel where I'm coming from. So when I was a TA at Carolina, there was this dude in my 8 o'clock Wednesday morning recitation, spring of 2005. And he was from some little bitty town in North Carolina. The most positive person I had ever met in my life. 8 a.m. I don't want to be there. Don't nobody else want to be there, but they all got to be there because if you're going to take Econ 10 at Carolina, which is like a macro-micro combination, like it was a mind blower of a course to have freshmen take. The recitation is where you actually learn how to do the stuff, right? Mm-hmm. I'm giving you the tips. And so they all had to be there, but he would always be there so happy. And I remember one girl that was in the class was just like, I love this guy just because he's always so positive. Like, he was that guy, but he was struggling early, man. Mm-hmm. And the way the course was set up, the professor went through all these ways to make it so that you could pass. So even if you failed every test up until the final, if you passed the final, you had a chance to pass the course. Like, it was that kind of thing. And he had been struggling early, and we were coming up on the drop date, and he asked me what I should do. And I did not have the heart to tell him to drop. He said the professor told him to drop. And I told him, look, I do not want to be the person to tell you that you can't do this, because I don't know if you can't do this. I know that you haven't done it thus far, but you need to look at yourself and you need to say, is there something else I can do? Because if there's something else that you can do, then you need to do that and make that happen. But if you look within yourself and honestly say, I've done everything I can, then you should probably let it go. Right. He stayed in the course. He passed. He's now working as an advisor to some politician in Texas or something like that. You know, like, he got his thing going. But I just remember I didn't have it in me to be like, nah, homie, you can't do it.
Yeah.
But that's a class.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? That's like different. Like, that's just teaching a class. So like, when people look at me in this job and they be like, yo, I see you and I see somebody who kicks it like you, and it makes me think that I can do it too. And I'm like, hey, buddy, no disrespect. But that's not, yeah. I can give you some other people to point to,
yeah,
where they should inspire you and make you believe that, hell, anybody can do this.
They don't mean no disrespect, but it's certainly disrespect. When people ask me, like, how do I get into this business or whatever, like, my normal response is, like, play in the NFL for 7 years. Then I'll give them some real advice after that. But the point is, like, I didn't plan to get here, and, like, the opportunity came to me. But the interesting thing about the story you told about the guy in econ class is, even if he had dropped, all the things, and I guess this is obvious, people know that, all the things that he has done to get him to that point still have value elsewhere.
Yes.
That's the really devastating and demoralizing thing about the dreams that little kids have that some people carry on into teenage years and adulthood, like sports and entertainment. that shit don't got no value nowhere else. Like, what you hit people for a living. That is not a useful skill.
Well, the problem is they don't do a good enough job, I think, in those places of explaining to people why those things might be useful. You know what I mean? So, like, I flunked out of graduate school from that PhD program that I was doing. I took a lot from those 2 years that I bring with me, right? Now, I remember once, this is 2006, when I was not full-time at ESPN, and I was at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention, and I was offended by the fact that I was not full-time. Like, I was working like I was full-time, but I was not full-time, and nobody was talking about making me full-time, and so I decided to sell myself to this woman named Lynn Cremondo. Lynn Cremondo was the managing editor of ESPN.com at the time, because I was writing, and I decided I was going to go in there and sell myself to her. And I don't think she's really trying to hear it, because the problem with trying to sell yourself is you are the most biased party in the world. But I'll never forget what she told me. She said, I studied dance in college. I was like, oh. And she says, you know what I learned? She said, I learned two things. I learned how to put on a show, and I learned how to do things in counts of eight. And so what she can do is take that rhythm, that ba, 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 ba. Like, her thoughts are segmented, and she thinks about everything that she does in those counts of eight. And so, like, she said that when she got to ESPN, she realized that her great value was, you know, it'd be a lot easier to read if you just turn that light on.
Yeah.
It was those kinds of things. And so, like, I look at football and different things, especially with football, because there's so many moving parts, and I can see, like, the value. But football ain't thinking about how to prepare. They talk all that. It prepares you for life. They try to prepare you for football. Yeah. They ain't got time to worry about what you're doing with life.
It don't. I mean, we know that all athletes put on their resume, I'm good at working in teams because I played football. It's different. Let me tell you that is very different, because when I left football to work in other teams, I realized that the way that you work on a team in football is an unacceptable way to behave on a team and anywhere else. Like, the direct way that you talk to people, the expectations that it's okay to have for people.
Yes.
Like, I had to get comfortable with people not being at meetings on time, because that's different. I had to get comfortable, or I had to figure out ways to communicate with people without being direct. And, like, you have certain expectations. It's different in football. It's quite clear most of the time whose fault it is. So you get in the meeting room and they like, hey, you ain't do this. Cover three is doing that. And, like, I guess you can go and be like, hey, well, coach shouldn't have called that coverage or something like that. But you have a job to do. And it's just, like, such a intense and, like, high stress situation. And and the time constraints are there, that you don't got time to do all these other things. So, like, people say, I'm comfortable, I'm a great teammate because I played sports. Nah, these teams are different outside of sports.
Yeah, but I do think that, especially with football, y'all know who the quarterback is.
Mm-hmm.
And y'all are, like,
hierarchy.
That's one good thing. Yeah, right. The one good thing that about athletes, especially in our space, is the understanding of, okay, you the one that run this? All right, got it. Cool, you know, we kind of sort of go from there. The direct thing is interesting because I am decent, I think, at figuring out ways to talk to people, but sometimes the only way to do it is to do it, and people have not come up in the space where people are doing it, and you go, and then it's just like, oh, man, I heard somebody's feeling.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much I'm supposed to care. I need to get, we need to get this thing here done.
I've learned to get better at it, but it also hurts in that people aren't direct with you.
That's my problem.
You've developed a way of listening and learning that's like, I want people to be like, hey, that ain't good enough, or this, you should do this. But people are like, hey, that was great. And then stop calling you.
That is the hardest one for me, because, like, yo, if it ain't good enough, I know this isn't personal. And it's interesting because I learned that from playing sports. Yep. Like, you didn't even have to play sports at a high level to understand that. You messed up here, person is going to tell you, you messed up here. They're not going to be mad at you forever about. Now, if you keep messing up, they go cumulatively be mad at you, you know?
Yeah. In youth sports, I guess they just stay mad at you all season. But if you cumulatively mess up in professional sports, you don't have to talk. They're going to tell you right off the top. And I'm sure people have seen, like, Hard Knocks and seen videos of coaches talking. I think Deion Sanders had one floating around recently. And he was like, you know what they do to you in the league if you don't show up on time? And one of his coaches was like, you cut. Like, it's something that we are taught from the time you're eight. Like, if you don't perform, if you're not trustworthy, if you're not reliable, you're done. And it's reinforced at every step of the way. We see it happen to our friends all the time. And then I get out here in these big companies where it's like, do the best that you can, but we ain't going to fire you or tell you that you stink.
Yeah. No. I'd like a lot more of both. let me tell you this. Ain't nobody never had no problem firing me when I wasn't up to snuff. They had no problem firing me when I was over snuff. in fact, where I look around and I'm like, yo, I think me and Snuff are about right here. Me and Snuff looking eye to eye, but Snuff is sticking around and his bum over here is still here. And I got to get out. Yeah. Nah, that's not like that Hard Knocks and them dudes walk in. That's what it was in grad school. You flunk out of grad school, they tell you. So the way it went for me was, you take qualifying exams, right? Different schools do it different ways, but they get you out. The difference between econ and everything else, they weed you early. Like year one, they start making these decisions. And so at some schools, you finish the semester in April, you take qualifying exams in June, you get your results, and then if you don't pass, you retake in August, and you don't even start year two if you ain't done it. Carolina was different. You took the first round of quals in August, and then the second round in January, December, January, one of those. And so after you've taken that second round, you go to your mailbox, and everybody's results are in. Mm-hmm. And you open it up. And I remember I opened that envelope up. I knew what time it was before I opened that thing up. And in retrospect, if that thing would have said I would have passed, I wouldn't have known what the hell I would have done with myself. I'd have been like, damn, I got to keep going. Like, I'm going to actually have to quit. Yeesh. Right? Like, I ain't had that in me. But that was the thing. It was like, at least they don't do that to the cats on Hard Knocks, where everybody just goes to the mailbox.
I mean, it's a similar thing. They send a dude around to come and grab you. I remember when I got traded, I was sitting before week one. It was the Monday, I guess, before week one. Just before we installed the packets, somebody came down. It was like, hey, coach need to see you. In the middle of the meeting, just before the meeting starts, I'm in there with the defensive guys. Like, Mike need to see you. I was like, I'm not going to get cut. Like, I'm the nickel at this point. I'm obviously going to be here. And cuts have already passed. Came upstairs and he was like, hey, we can send you to Kansas City or we can send you to Atlanta. Kansas City has a deal on the table. Atlanta is not offering you a deal. I'm going to let you pick. They offering the same thing. I was like, all right.
At least they did that.
Yeah, no, I got my issues with Mike Shanahan. I ran into him at the Hall of Fame. He was good to chat with him. I got my issues with him, but he ain't had to do that, and I appreciated that.
The Red Lobster.
He let his hair go gray, finally. It looks good.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Now, who's that? Fred Smoot calls him the Red Lobster, and that never stops being funny, because Fred Smoot, from his name being Fred Smoot all the way down, everything Fred Smoot says is just funny, every single bit of it. Now, the thing I told you we was going to talk about, and I'm going to try to keep it quick because I want to try to get to Michael K. Williams before we get done, though, was, I don't know about you, but this NFL season is coming up. And actually, before I get to that, I'm going to say this point right fast. People do realize that Bill Belichick did Cam Newton a favor, right?
I hope so.
Like, do people not get that?
I mean, it seemed like it worked for both of them, honestly, but yeah, I don't know.
It was like, I could keep you here, I could let you go find a job. Uh-huh. I'm going to let you go find a job. Dante Stallworth talked about that once, where Belichick cut him, but did it in a way to make sure that he would, like, ultimately be all right. But neither here nor there. I don't think there's any more fascinating question in the NFL this year than, so how good is Josh Allen going to be?
Yeah.
Because you and I, like, we've had our ride with Josh Allen, and I still think the weaknesses that we pointed out still exist. Uh-huh. But he's also figured out how to compensate for them.
Right.
So what we got?
Yeah, the coaches help and Stephon Diggs helps. I remember the year before Stephon Diggs got traded and we were just trying to fill time in the offseason. So on Get Up, they told me to make a list of your top five wide receivers. And I think I put Diggs at three. And he was with Kirk Cousins. And everybody was like, nah, you just hype on him because he's in Maryland. I'm like, watch this boy run these routes. He is killing fools out there. Kirk Cousins can hit him here or there, but he is a monster. Then he got traded. And we saw what he can do because beating man coverage is hard. And he beat man coverage, and Josh Allen was not good against man coverage. Like that, we talk about these lists, the rankings of top players throughout the – or coming into the season. Josh Allen may be an MVP. I mean, what Diggs meant to that offense and what he meant to that team, like that deserves some MVP consideration.
Yeah, the one thing about Josh Allen, we talked about this before, and I think this is what the league has figured out if they haven't. You can get them if you get pressure. Because if you get pressure on them, the panic might be there. But let me tell you what that pressure is going to have to be or what it can't be. It can't be no number 21. Yeah, It can't be no number 33. Uh-huh. It can't be no number 8. It can't be none of that. He's swatting them off. Like, he's not swatting them off like bugs on the windshield. He's swatting them off like rain on the windshield. Off
they
me.
Changed the numbers now, so I mean, it might be different. But you're going to have to be a big boy to bring him down. But, yeah, I mean... It's interesting because because he did it for an entire season, but I'm surprised that there aren't more questions about him because he had, I remember another time people asked, the producer on Get Up asked me to predict who's going to have a Josh Allen type leap in this coming season.
Like anybody's ever done that before.
Exactly. I said nobody, because no one's ever had a Josh Allen leap in the history of life. I said nobody. Like in the history of major professional sports, nobody had that leap. So he's going into, what's this, his fifth season? His fourth season, where he had two subpar seasons. I'm sure he would agree with that. And then one incredible year. No one has any questions about whether he can do it again. But I guess it's because he had it for a full year and they're bringing back just about all the important parts.
GTBW.
Yeah.
GTBW. That's what that comes down to. That is GTBW. White man just got to do it one time, man. All the white man got to do, like Ryan Fitzpatrick ain't even done it one full time. And people were still out here like, hey, well, you got to give him a chance to f it up. Right? Like it's you're obligated to allow him to burn the whole thing down just because he tricked you into optimism. You know what I'm saying? And that's the thing with Josh Allen is, while you still got people out here asking questions about Lamar Jackson, somehow everybody, like, you think they gonna figure out Lamar Jackson, like you could figure out being that fast. It seems to me it'd be a lot easier if figuring is as easy as people make it out to be, that it'd be a lot easier to figure out Josh Allen than it would be to figure out Lamar Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of figuring people out is, like, you can figure out how to stop a play, and then there is an answer to that normally. You can't figure out how to stop a great player. When you start talking about figuring out, you can figure out coordinators. You can't really figure out players, in my view. It's like, the player has talent. The coordinator needs to figure out how to make it work. But yeah, that's kind of outrageous. I wrote a piece that's up now, and we're recording this before the game, so hopefully Dak doesn't make me look crazy. But it's crazy how people still find ways to underappreciate and doubt Dak Prescott. And you and I were Dak doubters back in the day. But then we saw him play in that playoff game. That's all I needed. Because before the playoff game is rookie year, you and I both like...
That game against the Packers.
You and I both were like, hey, we're the only people who like put Romo in. Everybody's like, but they won so much with Dak. And me and you was like, no, but Romo's better. And then we watched the game. And somehow, inexplicably, we left the game, damn, Dak is real. And everybody else left the game thinking Dak is being carried. Like, they didn't watch the second half of that game, and they didn't realize that the only reason why the Cowboys lost, and we're not talking about that as Dak's emergence as an all-time clutch player, is because Aaron Rodgers did something miraculous.
Yeah. Now, I went that year to the Thanksgiving game against Washington, and I had seats about the 10th row in the end zone. And I saw why Dez Bryant was so frustrated with Dak Prescott. He'd be like, yo, he's right there. Like, I don't know the order of the reads, but I feel like this dude running this post with nobody around him should be the guy that you throw the ball to, right? I ain't no scientist, but I feel like that's what it should probably be. And then as it went, he got so much better. And Dak, we really got to look back and ask ourselves how two-time first-team all-SEC quarterback who took damn Mississippi State to the Orange Bowl slipped all the way down to the fourth round. Like, I know he had a DUI, but come on, they'll let that slide. Jameis Winston got drafted number one. You know what I mean? Like, I was stunned that this guy, like, we're going to look back and just be like, I don't understand how this happened. Because he has been a top five quarterback in the league and fully capable of being face of the franchise. You forget he's really the first black quarterback in the history of the Cowboys. Like, they had Quincy Carter. I'm not going to say there's never been a black dude to start at quarterback, but he's the starting quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. And yeah, I don't know what Dak gonna have to do in order to make people think. But to be fair to him, hey man, we ain't believe in Tony Romo until ever. Yeah. Like, it never came back around. But this is gonna be an interesting season in that regard. But we got about 10 minutes left. And so I wanted to talk about this, as you are a native of Baltimore. And I just watched The Wire a lot. And Michael K. Williams, who played Omar, passed away on Sunday, I believe the day was. Rest in peace to him. And I just can't think of a character, like, from the outside, somebody who doesn't have a relationship with that city. That is like the most resonant television character that I can think of, that just in every way had people like, yo, I ain't never seen nothing like this before, while also making it wildly relatable.
It was incredible. And like the Baltimore thing, it was nice because like they'd reference Lake Trout over by Pimlico and stuff like that. That was cool. And they like play club music in the back every now and then. It was cool to like hear these things and be from Baltimore. But The Wire to me wasn't about Baltimore. Like, it was about America or society. It's about one of the themes that we talk about on this show a lot is like The Wire was about failed institutions to me, you know, yes. And the ecosystem that is born out of those failed institutions. And Omar in that, like, I don't know what he was meant to represent, but to me, he kind of represented what was right, represented what was fair and like justice that no one else could speak to. And I guess it was fitting that he ended up getting killed at the end because it like spoke to what I felt was the whole message is like all these institutions are failing and no one individual or one particular institution can solve the problems that are keeping everybody in these situations. It's like too big for any one person or one institution to solve. And I thought that Michael K. Williams and Omar Little character was like perfect for that.
I also felt like it pointed out the fluidity of morality as a concept, because within that world, he is highly moral. He also kills a lot of people, right? And even the idea of him jacking up the drug dealers is based on a morality, because ain't nothing more player hating than robbing somebody, right? But there's a morality fundamental, and then a weird fundamental morality in it, in that he's stealing they dope and then giving they dope to people who honestly probably don't need to be using no dope, while the character who is doing this is someone who is a, like the actor playing this character is actually a drug addict. You know, like it combined all of that. But like one thing I thought that I always thought was dope about The Wire that I think was underrated is how regular these people actually are, right? Like what I think it did for a lot of white people who watch The Wire, who just don't know nobody who's ever lived a life like that. Like I didn't grow up in that neighborhood or something like that, but I know people, you know. But if you don't know nobody like that, it's hard for you to think of them as just being people who wound up like in a set of circumstances. So to me, maybe the most underrated Omar scene of all of them. Everybody remembers when Omar was taking his grandmama from church on the Sunday truce and Stringer told them cats it was okay to shoot Omar up and they shot Omar's grandmama's crown off the top of her head as she was coming out of church. Which, by the way, again, the fluid morality where Avon and all those cats are just like, you disrespectful little dudes, you know, for going out here and doing this. But it's a scene after that where Omar's so mad because, duh, they just almost shot his granny. And he's explaining how he has been lying to her for years. And he told her that he worked at a cafeteria at the airport, as if the airport has cafeterias. That he had a, he worked at a cafeteria at the airport because he knew that his grandmama would never go to the airport. So she would never know that he did not work there. And yes, this dude that's out here, the most feared man in the streets, ripping and running, robbing everybody, is just like you lying to your granny because you don't want to disappoint her with the heathenous life that you are actually living, right? He was just so upset because his grandmama was going to find out that he actually be out here robbing people.
They were playing a game in his mind and the rules were set up and there was a society. And I think the way that you justify Omar, or at least I justify Omar stealing drugs and money from drug dealers and giving some money to the women in the community that needed it and giving drug to drug dealers, was Omar understood that the institutions had failed these people. And he understood that they had no hope. And he understood that there was no opportunity. And he understood that they were hooked on this. And like, why try to get them clean? For what? Why not give them what they need? And that's why, like, to me, that's what he represented in this, was like the only right way to act given these circumstances. And you see, I think your point about like people who are not, it feels like you say white people in part because like all black people, we feel like at least 1 or 2 degrees.
Yeah, we can't segregate ourselves the same way.
And the point that we all pretend like we know that everyone's the same, but the point about them being just like you, but in these circumstances, like that is why this show was so popular, because it was the first time that I think it successfully convinced them of that. And like the season two was like a precursor to the political climate that we're in now. Like the Doc thing, like it spoke to all those aggrieved white people who are also poor and struggling, but feeling left behind. And that they became, some of them became drug dealers, but in our world, some of them become like weird fringe political people because they find hope there. But the last thing I'll say on it is, like, I listen to a lot of Andre 3000 generally, but a lot more this weekend because that verse came out and it was great. But it just made me listen to some old stuff. And I was thinking about 16's Not Enough, where Andre says, "She's yelling that selling's a sin. So is telling men that selling's a sin. If you don't offer new ways to win, a dolphin gonna shake his fin regardless if he gets in or out of water. Most important thing is to swim. Like, that to me encapsulates why the kids become drug dealers. And I know you hate Stringer Bell, but like, you put Stringer Bell in that situation. And like, Michael ended up becoming the next Omar, but like, you put these kids that are smart, talented in these situations, what else are they gonna do but try to swim, whether you put them in or out of water?
And now, since you brought up goddamn Stringer Bell, I know, but like, got to something that you had tapped on early, and I was gonna let it go, but now I'm gonna bring it back. We talked about that people saw these cats as being regular, and that was the first time that they could see themselves in those people. And the reason why I hate Stringer Bell so damn much is there's so many people out here that look out there and they'd be like, yeah, I'd be Stringer Bell if I was in that game. And you know what that would make you? You ain't shit. That's what that would make you if you were Stringer Bell. Like, they don't realize that if you identifying yourself as the person that would be that dude, then you a snake. Right? Like, those people think that him and his snake-like behavior somehow made him better than the rest of them cats, and that's because deep down in your soul, Mr. White Man, you are also a snake. And I say Mr. White Man because it was staged by and large being white people. Like, well, he wanted to be bigger than a drug dealer. Right. He was trying to turn this into a business, as though there's some morality in business. Yeah. Right? No, the only difference is they don't shoot you when you make a mistake. But, but there ain't no morality in this. And so they somehow think that just because this dude out here wearing sweaters, that he's somehow better than somebody else.
You don't hate Stringer. You hate the people who latch on to Stringer.
I hate them all.
That ties into some of my football takes that get people upset. It's like, I don't have any problems with the player. It's some of the players that latch on to it. But Omar is the one that killed Stringer. And Omar had this part in the courtroom that speaks to what you were saying. It was outstanding. Where he's on the stand and he's snitching, essentially, and the attorney kind of judges him for robbing drug dealers. And then he turns it back around on him. It's like, you ain't no different. You the same as me. You just got a briefcase and I got a shotgun.
You got the briefcase, I got a shotgun. So, all in the game, right?
Exactly. You watch this show plenty of times like me. But, I mean, the point there is, you're right. If we're watching that show, Stringer Bell is not the person who I identify with or the person who I look up to or root for. People who look up to and root for Stringer Bell have misunderstanding of morality.
Oh, I want to be clear. I hate Stringer Bell, just to be explicit. He tried to kill all the characters that I like. He tried to send my man Avon to jail. I ain't the biggest D'Angelo Barksdale fan in the world, but he was scheming on his girl from day one, then had him killed in the joint so he could keep sleeping with his girl, and then tried to act like he was doing it for the operation, as if when you kill your girl's baby daddy, anything else matters. That's the only thing that matters. This buster out here kicking it like that, and people be out here, oh man, he was my favorite character on the show. I can't trust you. That's all I know when you tell me that right there. You tell me Omar's your favorite character in the show, you probably stand for something, or who knows, you just wear soft pajamas. You know what I'm saying? And ain't no shade in that, ain't no problem with that. You know, you like to feel tender when you go to bed. That's cool. I understand where it come from. But Stringer Bell, I'm telling you, man, had me out here like, I need to look up apartheid, because maybe it's not as bad as I thought it was. If apartheid was holding Stringer Bell down in that movie, you ever seen Stringer Mandela? Like, you go watch Stringer Mandela, and I look at Stringer Mandela as a movie, and I'm just like, Nelson Mandela, this dude don't look nothing like Nelson Mandela. He ain't got nothing in common with Nelson Mandela. Y'all just wanted to make Nelson Mandela somebody that the women found to be sexy. So you let this snake slide on his belly and come out here and pretend to be Nelson Mandela and turn your whole movie into Stringer Mandela instead of Nelson
Mandela.
Don't he
Mandela. Rap, too?
He makes beats.
He got beats.
He tries to rap. He used to sell weed. He been all over the place.
Yeah, I'm not a Stringer Bell fan. I'm not going to hold it against Idris in the way that you do.
I wish I would have shot him myself. I love all the movies where Stringer Bell dies. I loved it in American Gangster. He got shot right on the street in front of everybody. That should have been a lesson to kids out here. Don't be a snake. Like, everything about him, I just feel like we need to tell people, stop being snakes.
Because he got on a sweater and he was trying to go clean everybody. And he was willing to, that's the worst part, is like, he was willing to step on people, betray people, cut people off to get to a place where he was separated. Like, that's crabs in a barrel.
Yeah, didn't bring nobody with him. And guess what? That's why the white man got you. I ain't never rooted for a crooked white man in my life like I rooted for them when they was rocks. Clay Davis, that's how you teach these cats. You know what I'm saying? That's what you do. Throw that crab back in that barrel. He ain't getting out neither. He ain't getting out neither. Omar put that shot. Well, get it over with. Don't mind if I do. Bow. Put that. Boom. That's what we do.
It's emotional, but you're still catching them words as they coming up.
Yeah, yeah. But to Michael K. Williams, because this ain't about the snakes right now. This is about the G's. Yeah, no, it's my fault. It just happens. Another one, because we're coming close on time. Did you watch Boardwalk Empire? All right, now, you want to talk about a dynamic that I'm just very curious how it came together and everybody put it together, was the Chalky White Narcisse dynamic on Boardwalk Empire, because this was some very subtle stuff about black people that was going on with that. And so Chalky White is this obviously clearly dark-skinned, from the mud sort of gangster who got up, got some money, got the light-skinned girl, had the light-skinned kids, and now got these kids who he can't relate to, who can't relate to him. They bring it over some bougie boy, and they ain't trying to eat the Hoppin' John like he likes, uh-huh. You know, from back in the day and everything else. And then they introduce that Narcisse character who shows up with his judgment because he sees Chalky White is basically holding the black man down while Narcisse is trying, you know, the classic light-skinned, you know, Creole type dude who's latched on with Marcus Garvey and feels like cats like him are holding the revolution back. But there was such a subtlety in the interplay. They nailed that. And I thought that his character got the gangster and the insecurity all at one time, because Omar has no insecurity. Right. Like, that was the biggest difference. Chalky White shared what the insecurity was for a man of that time, of that place, all of those things.
Jeffrey Wright was the Narcisse character, and I remember seeing all those things and having similar thoughts as you. It was like, I didn't love that show, honestly.
I didn't either.
It was okay, but that part was the part that I got into, and that interplay, and like, then they brought out Marcus Garvey. But Jeffrey Wright, the way he played that role, he was playing it in a way that I could imagine would make you hate all the other things that he does going forward. But he was good in that other HBO show that he was in. What's that one? The one with the robots? Oh, Westworld. Oh,
okay. Nah, I love the character that he had in there. Man, this has been a good podcast. Dominique Fosworth, check him out at theundefeated.com. His story on Dak is really, really good. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing 3 times a week. My man Gabe Bassain, Dave Presley handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.